I have a six-year-old daughter, and when I see that kid, I light up like Christmas, and I sometimes say, is that you? The program has more and more taught me, when I see a lot of faces in here, I do light up like Christmas, and just seeing so many of you, and I go, is that you? I have two friends, and they have been such darn shining examples of not just program, but just how to live a good life. They are such a happily married couple, it makes you want to puke. And I just adore these people. I mean, it's not putting them up on a pedestal, but you two guys are my heroes, Tom and Alice. And Tom, if you'd like to start, I sure would appreciate it. Come on up.
Love you.
You too.
Mind your P's and Q's, Tom.
I'm Tom. It seems there was this well-meaning Al-Anon out for a jog, and he came across this guy laying on the sidewalk. The guy's legs were under the bushes, and he was laying there, and he came over, and he determined in the wee hours of the morning that the guy was drunk. He decided to help him out, so he picked him up and he leaned him against himself, and he got his cell phone out, and he called up a cab, and while he's making the call, the guy falls over, and he bangs his head, and a little blood comes out. Cab arrives. Few falls later, short ride later, they're arriving at the address that the guy found in the guy's wallet on his pants. And getting out of the cab, he tells the cabbie to wait, and he stands the guy up. Guy falls over again, bangs his head, and big knot on his head now. He wrestles the guy to the door. He's got this prize, bleeding and bruised, but he's got this prize next to him. He rings the doorbell, and he wakes this poor lady up who comes to the door, and she looks at him, and he says, does this guy live here? And she says, yeah. And she looks past him and says, where's his wheelchair? I fully identify with that jogger. Often my solutions to your problem are worse than the original problem. And as funny a story as that is, and as silly a story as that is, I actually did do that once. Early in our time together, when Alice and I were real new together, and it was a lot of years ago now, she was new in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I used to see her get into her beat-up old Plymouth Fury. This thing had, I'm going to steal some of her thunder right here, perhaps. This thing had one of those vinyl, those Landau roofs, you know, it flapped in the wind, and it had the Bondo and stuff. It was a true drunk mobile, and she was new in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I met her after she got in AA, and I used to watch her get into the car with these women and drive off to these ridiculously sordid places and pick up substandard human beings as a condition of her sobriety and take him to meetings, and it was astounding to me, because she would go into places like Hollywood and the edge of downtown LA and just all over the, you know, hell and back, and she'd bring these people to meetings, and I was impressed by that. And one night, working my after the shift of my swing shift job, I got off and I saw this pile of drunkenness laying on the street. And I pulled my car right up to the guy. I was in a bus stop, and he was laying next to the bus bench. And I picked him up, and I got him in my car. And through the magic interpretation of shouting at the top of my lungs to a totally Spanish-speaking blackout drunk in English, because I don't know any Spanish, I slowly got it out of him. It took about an hour. I swear it took about an hour to get us about 8 miles away. Because I kept trying to figure out what street he lived on. And I knocked on his door, and I surprised his wife and ambushed her. And, you know, it wasn't funny. You know, she came to the door, and she looked at him, and she saw this. She was concerned when she came to the door. But when she saw who it was, you could just see her whole countenance just fell. And she just, you know, she just... What I've realized since that time is there's more recovery in sore bones and even jail time than there is in all the feather pillows and hot showers in the world. Because when they have to take their lumps, they get it. When they don't have to take their lumps, they don't get it. That's true in Al-Anon as well. I have to tell you that I believe that what makes me who I am, to the degree that I am, and that person is somebody that needs to tell you what to do, needs to straighten out your morals, needs to tell you when you're doing something wrong, needs to correct the neighbors and hang pictures that don't belong to me on walls that I don't own. But I have that need. I just need to correct things sometimes. And the reason I'm that way is because of the profound lack of organization and turmoil that I was raised in. And I didn't realize it until almost 4 years ago. I've been saying, I'm all right, I'm okay, it wasn't that bad, for years. My mother and her brother, my uncle, during the Great Depression were handed over to an orphanage in Milwaukee by their own mother, because the mother was given a choice of a hand in marriage to the man who proposed or her babies. And she took the hand, and she dropped the kids at the orphanage, and that's where they were raised for their whole lives. That man and that grandmother of mine went on to raise an entire happy family after that. That's the mother's side. Around that same time in Milwaukee, within years really, not within weeks or moments, but within the same hunk of years, my father, who was 6 years old at that time, was being taken away from his family and put in an institution. He was in a family of 12 children, immigrant parents, and they couldn't handle them anymore. And he was 6 years old. I have to tell you that when my father was telling me this story, it was after a lot of years of reconciliation, because there was some wreckage between then and the eventual where he is today. But he was told by the authorities that if he snuck back to his house or if he left the institution, that they would jail his parents. And when he was telling me this story, he was sitting at one end of my dining room table. And on the other side of the dining room table was my own six-year-old son. I got a real visual of what that looked like, because my son's never had to do anything like that, sneak around the streets of Milwaukee and sleep in cars. And that's how my dad's life started. And he began his life of crime and his life of abuse that way, abuse of himself and abuse of other people. And I want you to know that those two that got together in 1949 that decided to raise a family. My mother from the orphanage and Emil, my father, and these two ridiculously damaged human beings. They went on to have a daughter, my older sister, in 1950. They had me in 1953, and they had my younger sister in 1957. In between, prison stays, because my father just couldn't keep his hands off other people's property, and he wasn't very social in any sense of the word. I really barely knew him. One of my strongest memories of him and family strife is, in later years, my older sister, who had spent a lot of years as a very small child in a hospital, 6 months stint at one time. I mean, she was my best friend. She was an extremely violent child, too. She was in the second grade. Picture a second grader. If you don't remember what a second grader stand, they stand this high. They stand lower than my belt, most of them. And she was in the second grade. And in an inner city in Milwaukee, she was challenging and beating up African-American boys in the fifth grade. I used to watch it on the playground. She would fly at them like a windmill. I'd never seen anything like it, haven't seen anything like it since. A small child like that, absolute Tasmanian devil, all over this poor kid. I mean, he'd be down on the ground bleeding and crying and crying for help. And she did it guy after guy. Guys, not women, not girls, the boys that could fight. And she was that violent. She went into the hospital, and in the hospital, she almost lost her life to a disease, but she was also introduced to a lot of opiates. And so when they delivered that kid back home, preteen, what we had in the house was a couple of alcoholics. My mother was, my dad, they say you shouldn't, you can't. I got a big stamp that says dad, boings, alcoholic. That's just for him, right for his forehead. And then my sister, who was some kind of drug addict, who knows, I'm not really sure, prescription drugs in the 50s. They gave you everything you wanted and more. And that's what we had at the house. We eventually, my dad, when he was doing another prison stint, my mother moved us all to California. And my sister, going from preteen to teen with all the drugs and all the, and by the way, there was a sexual lines were blurred in my house through a sexual addict that was living with us from time to time. And he brought in partners, and those partners involved themselves with my sister. I'm as convinced as I can be without having seen it or seen some kind of deposition or something. I'm pretty convinced because her behavior was very bizarre, and I only realized that through inventory and looking back on a lot of that. So what we have in California now is a girl that's ripe and ready for the sexual and the drug revolution of the 1960s. And she ran away and she went up to... I'm going to be processing up here too, by the way. She ran away and she went up to San Francisco, and she, in her life, this is not her inventory, but just to tell you how nuts it was, she had a three-month period of her life that she can't remember behind speed. That's not the usual reaction to speed. That's usually alcohol, opiates, you know, barbiturates, stuff like that. A three-month period where she can't remember where she was, but there was evidence in there that she was being handed around from gang to gang, bed to bed, floor to bed, back and forth. And that's the way she was living. And this was after a very violent, she ran away up there after an extremely violent exchange with my dad. I can remember it very clearly. My dad was a army-trained boxer, and he was fresh from prison, and he was plopped in among these two teenage kids that were out of hand, out of control, and he was frightened. And he dealt with it the only way he knew how. I'm almost certain my sister started it because she was that violent. But what I saw and how I saw it ending was my dad moving her into the corner of our apartment living room with a series of body blocks and punches that I had never seen before, and I was watching from behind. He was so skilled. He was so good. She was all over him. She was trying to do to him what she used to do to the little boys, and he was having none of it, and it had gotten to the point where everybody was drunk and loaded enough, and I watched him systematically beat her down, and she finally ended up running away that night. I was jumping around behind him, absolutely frightened out of my mind of him and of it. But I had a butcher knife in my hand, and it was like a 14-inch job. He was a machinist, and he made it himself. It was like a damn machete. I want to say 14 inches. I think I'm wrong. I think the damn thing was about this long. But I had it ready to go. I was looking for a chance, but I was too afraid of him. I was afraid he was going to hurt me that way. What I saw him doing to her, I didn't want any real part of, but I couldn't. I wanted it to stop, too. So I walked around back and forth behind him, cowardly, thinking and hoping that I could get my moment. I never did. That didn't work out. She ran away. We ended up somehow making it through school and whatever, and I got through high school, and I got myself a job, and I got myself situated entirely differently after that. I'll tell you how differently here in a second. In all fairness to my dad, as a reflection of what alcoholism can do to a family, in all fairness, I have to tell you that when I saw him doing that, I remember this other picture of him that I remember almost clearer than the boxing incident. When I was a little boy myself, I was 4 years old, and I think I was wearing a matching shirt that he was wearing. My mother brought me to his place of work. He was a barber, and he was cutting somebody's hair. And I remember sitting in the chair and just watching him. I can warm myself on the sunlight of that room nearly. I can remember it so clearly. But I was watching him, and I was just swollen with pride watching my daddy cut this guy's hair and do this job. And it was just marvelous because he was in charge. He was cutting, you know, he was telling people when to sit down, and he was cutting their hair, and you know, he gave us the seats, and he had his back to me, and he was cutting away, and I was just looking at him, and I was just marveling at it and enjoying the moment, watching him without him watching me. And then I looked over to the side a little bit, and I realized he was watching me. He was staring at me in one of the barber mirrors that I hadn't seen. And he was just staring at me. And he had this stare. I mean, he had this stare. Some people say I have an intense face. Not like Dad's. No, nothing like it. But he had this stare, and he was looking at me. But I could tell. The feeling was palpable. I could feel his love through the sort of devilish look on his face because he was catching me. But yet he just adored me. He just adored me. And that's a moment that I've really not been able to fully realize what was happening there until I became a father myself. And I have a son whom I love more than air. I just love that boy. And he's everything to me. But I have to tell you, he's the reason I'm in this program. I want to warn you, young folks that are about to have a baby or thinking about it, think of it this term, these terms. You're going to have a teenager. And then process it and enjoy. We've been through it and we've made it through, but we only made it through, honest to God, it was after getting to Al-Anon that I was put onto something else that I've tried to share with a few of you guys that have kids. Absolutely turned us around. And if you want to hear about it, please get my number and I'll tell you what I learned. Certainly what I learned in here. But the reason I came here is because I was losing my relationship with my son. We had some recovery under our house, and we had some semblance of this and some semblance of that, and we even decided to go to church. I discovered God a while back. Say, I discovered him. He let me discover him, and he finally got my damn attention, is what I'm trying to tell you. And Alice and I were one night were wondering, well, what do we do to raise our kid in this crazy ass world? And we couldn't sleep, some years prior we had decided, we had learned somewhere to not make the bed a place where you talk about money or stressful things, and not even watch television. It's for a couple of other things. And we got up and we went out into the living room, and we sat in the living room, in a very prayerful way we came up with what we need to do is deliver our son to God if we can, and God to him if we can. So we started going to church. And in fact, it has taken to this very day. My son will ask for prayers and things like that. And that worked out really well for a while. We got pretty involved in a rather conservative church. It didn't stick. Not like this. Not like this stuff. You know, this is forever. Those other stuff, we'll try it modularly and like that. But Alice's sobriety and my involvement in Al-Anon is more important than I can even tell you. And I want to pause here for a moment to tell, because I'm afraid I'll forget at the end. I'm one of the men of this group. I'm one of those men you admire, ma'am, that you think are so open and willing to learn. You're absolutely right. That's what we have here. I when I see these men, John says, "Oh, it's you. It's you." When I sit across from them, I just look at one face after another. I go, "God, I love that guy. Oh, I love him too. I'm crazy about him." And it's like that. It's never been like that anywhere else in any other part of my life where I've looked at men the way I have in this room, because the men here are teaching me how to be a man among them. There's a guy here, and Kevin, I don't even know if you're here tonight, but he came up with, he believed when he came to us that we were going to give him a man pill. And teach him how to be a man. And in fact, we do. We give you 12 of them. And when those 12, when you learn those 12, we give you another 12. And after that, there's 12 promises. And when you put all those together and you start all the possibilities of mathematics between those things, adding, subtracting, multiplying, you come up with an infinite way of being able to look at other resources and say, I can learn from that because that reminds me a little of that. And you start looking for the good stuff. Does anybody know what these things are? That's a purple band. Anybody know? Just raise your hand if you do. Okay. Have you got yours? I'm not going to go on about it, because it's not Al-Anon. But what it is, the whole goal of these things is a pastor. So I picked up a book, because I learned to read here, by the way. And I picked up a book, and I got interested in what they were talking about. It was A Complete Free World was the thought behind it. And the symbol of it is this silicone bracelet. You put it on your wrist, and when you the goal is to go, when you complain, you switch like that. You catch yourself complaining, and you switch every time you complain out loud. And so I'll tell you, some days I get myself rug burn bringing this thing back and forth. Not the fun rug burn either. I mean, the bad stuff. Because I'm a complainer. Anyway, the goal is to go 21 days without having to move this ever. You know, 21 days without having moved your bracelet. And then you're into, I don't know what happens to you then. I really don't know. You disappear, I guess. I'm going to disappear. That'll be for sure. Anyway, I've had it for months now. I even put one on my, well, I'll tell you that in a second. No. God, you're a dirty crowd. But because of the things we teach us here, we're able to learn from these other places. And I'm profoundly grateful to you men. I'm profoundly grateful to you men for not only, there's another saying here, I hear it often in the meetings, you guys make me want to be a better man. You know, it's kind of a paraphrase from As Good As It Gets. You guys make me want to be a better man. And that's true, you do. And I've added something to that. You not only make me want to be one, you show me how. You dust off a seat and you ask me to sit down and you ask me to share and you share back and you save lives and you save families and you build homes. This group is absolutely famous throughout the country, I'm finding out. Every time I talk to somebody who travels and is not from here, they know about this group. I mean, in Al-Anon, they know about this group. Anyway, I feel really, really privileged to be here, and I hope you know that. I hope I don't ever not reflect that when I'm standing toe-to-toe with you men and I'm talking to you. Please don't allow me to do that, because I have a profound love and respect and care for you, and I certainly am thankful. Last month, my son, he's now the son that I got to know very well what his throat felt like in this hand when he was 15. I know what that 15-year-old throat feels like. And I pictured myself in those years, hand on throat, reaching for a relationship with my dad who was not there really. He's still in my life, but he's been divorced and alienated from the family. Today, right now, in fact, my phone's on vibrate in case I get the call. He's in VA hospice right now, and he's on the shy side of 90 pounds in weight. And what I was going to tell you earlier is I took one of these, and I slipped it on his wrist, and I just enjoy seeing it there because he's such a complainer. His whole job is to breathe and to get a little liquid in him and to stay alive. I watch him grab the rail once in a while and adjust his rib cage around so he can get it just so and get a little air into his lungs for that particular pull. And he uses every stinking cubic pica of his breath to complain and to blame. He's one of the poorest men I know. He's never gotten it. You guys have given me a message. You've given me a guess. The message is that God exists. It's actually a message from God. He wants me to deliver that once in a while. It says it right in my 11th step in the paths to recovery. It says, pray for people that they find God. Right at the end there, it talks to me about that. The first step, oh my God, the recovery began right then. That ponderous list of things that I don't have power over. And then I get to practice the insanity of writing that list and thinking, oh, this is the one I can throw off the list. It's repeating the same thing over and over again, expecting different results. I'll write it down, and I'll go, no shit, that does belong there. And I got it. You know, it was a funny step, really. I don't know if I really did. I say I did. It's probably hyperbole. I don't know if I called my sponsor and really did say it, but I should have. I should have said, I get it. Okay, I'm done writing. I get it. I'm powerless over everything. I get it. He talks about the hula hoop. You stand in the hula hoop, you have control of what's in there. And I don't even buy that. When I look closely, I don't even have control of half of what's going on with me. My son is doing well. He's in the United States Merchant Marine Corps. I want to thank you, fellow taxpayers, very much for that one. He got an appointment by our congressman, and he's there, and he's getting a fine education. It's hard for him. It's real hard for him, but we're a great base for him. There's Skype, there's texting, there's a lot of stuff. We were visiting him last month, and we were at a local hotel out in Long Island, and I was in this cozy little room that I loved it. I found a fireplace, and I was drinking coffee, and I was meditating, and I was thinking about how great life was, and I was thinking about how wonderful my wife is and how my son was doing well, and here we are in Long Island visiting him. And this guy came in, and he turned on the TV, and he blared it. And I just, you know, but I'm spiritually charged right now, so I'm going to be okay. I really am. I'm going to be fine. But I finally saw it. Then I saw it. Then I, you know, my mind went, but this is an opportunity to help a human being see things differently. So I did. I made my best effort. And I walked up to him. I approached him from behind. He was in a wingback chair. And I said, like only I can do, instead of saying, excuse me, sir, I'm already so driven up. I want to say, excuse me, sir, but it comes out more like, hey, pal. I see the white hair, so I'm okay saying that. From the back, I said, hey, pal, can you mind turning that down? And I had this whole salvo in the breech ready to go, this whole bunch of other shit that I was going to say to him when he said no. It was ready to go. It was cocked. It had it ready. I had it leveled just about at his stomach. He didn't see it, but I had it there. And he turned around, and he immediately and cheerfully took care of the problem. How he did it was he bent the neck that was barely bendable and took what looked more like a skin paw than a hand, and he pressed the buttons on the deal to get the effect I wanted. And he turned to me, and he was pleasant. And I went back to my coffee, and I just withered. And I just sat there, and I finally worked up the courage to strike up a conversation with him. And what I learned about him was he was a military plane fire crash survivor. And he was going around the country, as he had been for years, inspiring, informing, and involving other burn victims, and that's what he did. And he had, before we parted, he asked me, he gave me his website address, and he said, look me up. And I did. And I want to read something from his website that I saw. You've heard this, perhaps? I've heard it before, but I've never heard it on the tail end of what I just told you. And so it's, that has that much more meaning for me. And by the way, when I'm done, I'm just going to sit down and ask my wife to come up and see if she'll tell you how I got my nickname. This is what he had on his website. This is the prayer he likes to say every day. Dear God, so far today, I've done all right. I haven't gossiped. I haven't lost my temper. I haven't been grumpy, nasty, or selfish. Some of you know this, don't you? But in a few minutes, God, I'm going to get out of bed. And that is when I'm going to need a lot of help. Amen.
Hi, my name's Alice. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, Alice. This is terrifying. I've done this before, and it's always scary. I hate it. So thank you, John, for asking us to come. And thanks, Tom, for such a wonderful talk. We learn a lot about each other in the rooms, and I'm so thankful to be able to share the 12-step program with him. We have a really good life, and he's really crazy. We need every meeting, every sponsor, every inventory, every step, every minute of every day. You know, we're like, what did my son used to call us? What is it, like kindling and, you know, matchsticks or something? He had a nickname for us, like that if you put us together, we would blow up. And that's what it was like. Unfortunately, raising our son for a lot of those years, there was a lot of peaceful times, but there was a lot of really volatile times. Tom mentioned the nickname I have for him, and I think some of you know that nickname, but I don't think he knows I have another nickname for him, and it's Rescue Dog. I got this rescue dog, and he's a chihuahua about this big, and he's so scary. He's like this, he's a very ferocious little scared animal. Anyway, he reminds me of my husband. So their personalities are so similar. You know, you just be sitting there touching him, and everything's fine, and then he's like, what happened? And then he's just like, everything's fine, and then he kind of, you know, prances through the kitchen again. I mean, that's the dog, but it's like, what? When I remember before cell phones, I remember when we got cell phones, and then you could talk on the cell phone before you came home, and so I'd talk on the cell phone and be, oh, okay, and then I'd come home 10 minutes later, and it was like there was a different man in the house. You know, it wasn't the man that I talked to on the telephone. I was like, what? Anyway, so I do have ways to deal with that. I don't drink. I don't use. I don't take anything that affects me from the neck up. To take care of my emotions and my feelings. And when do I stop talking? I didn't hear. 27 after? 25 after?
26.
Okay, John. 26 after. Totally lost my... So what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. When I was a small child, I needed a drink very badly. I can remember being 5, you know. I can remember being afraid to talk to people, and I can remember being in a lot of fear. I was just afraid of everything. I was afraid everything and everybody was going to die. And I thought about it a lot. And so I was afraid. And there's a dog in this story too. Actually, my mother had wanted to get a family dog, and I'll try to make this short. We went to get this dog, and I was living in Germany, and we went to this home, and there was a basement, and there was all these little puppies down there, and they let me pick the one we took home. I'm not sure why they let me pick, but there was one that looked really sick and sad, and I said, I wanted that one. So they said, okay. Anyway, we took it home, and truly, it was very sick and very sad, and it almost died, and so my mother had to nurse it for about a week, and I was afraid it was going to die, like I was afraid everybody was going to die, and so... She nursed him to life, and he was okay. But I remember after it was all over, I went to my father and I said, "How long do dogs live?" And he told me, and I kind of did, you know, the 5-year-old mental. I figured out that I would be some kind of like old teenager when the dog died, and I thought, that won't do. I can't go through the death of this adorable animal. And so I just had this little switch in me and went snap, and I just snapped it off, and I couldn't stand that dog. And I never invested anything into that dog. And it was her dog. And so that's how I started dealing with my bad feelings. I just didn't deal with them. I just turned away or shut you down or whatever it was. So When I just kind of went from one thing to the next in my early childhood and just kind of got into junior high and high school and just whatever. And I didn't realize that I was just trying to find the first drink, really. In high school, I was with my family at a Christmas party, and we got... I was with somebody that made me rum and coke. And I had 3 of them. And they must have been strong. And they were my first real drinks. And I remember getting into my parents' car to be driven home. And I I passed out. I blacked out. I threw up. I was horribly sick. And, you know, when I came to in the morning, I just thought, wow, I want to do that again. You know, it was like, wow, that was great. And there was, you know, barf everywhere, and they were mad at me. And it was just like, so what? That was great. And so I kind of pursued that for really, actually, a kind of a small window of time. I mean, you know, I think the wonderful thing about the programs are, you know, you go and you hear people's stories, and they're all so different, and they're all so the same, but they're all so different, you know, and so the same. I couldn't wait to do it again, and my window of drinking years was just 9 years. So it's really, you know, in life, it's not that long. Those first 6 years, I was just having a good time with it like that, you know, just, yeah, let's drink. I was drinking in the car, a little bottle of whiskey and the right guy and my girlfriends. And it was always so fun and kind of periodic. And there was, you know, high school in there and marching band and trips and ski trips, just stuff that I did. And then I kind of got away with it. So there was nothing really bad about it for those first 6 years. And when I was in college, I I met a guy that I didn't have any sense of myself or decision making. I just kind of, you know, one thing to the next, whatever. And so I liked this guy and I wanted to move in with him, and I told my mother, and my mother and I have like no relationship at all, but for the once I listened to her, she said, no, you can't move in with him, you have to get married. And so I cornered him in a restaurant and cried until he said he would. And so we got married and it was a disaster. You know, it was like, you knew that, right? Okay, good. I mean, right? Okay, I gotta be careful what I tell him and what I don't tell him. Oh no, that's okay. I always read my inventories to him. No, I don't. I don't really. So anyway, I married this guy. Anyway, that's what I'm trying to say is that when that relationship ended, my drinking took off. I was in so much pain. It ended. I was in a bar. I was with a guy. I was in a bar. I was with a guy. That was my life after that for the next few years. I left. I was in Pittsburgh. I left Pittsburgh. I came out to California to be a star. You know, here I am. You all know me, right? So I worked in a lot of restaurants. A lot. And had some bad experiences there, but that's okay. I hope I didn't wait on any of you. If I did, I'm sorry. I'm making my amends to you now. I was the most horrible. I was your nightmare waitress for a very long time. And I'm talking deep into my sobriety. I was a really bad I'll tell you stories. But you know what? It's time. I have like a minute to get sober and wrap this up. So I met a guy in an acting class that I was in, thinking that I was there to learn about acting. But what happened was I got introduced to the program. And, you know, I looked at him and I said, I won't say exactly what I said because my sponsor said I shouldn't cuss from the podium. But I said, what the are you so happy about all the time? And he said, well, I've got a relationship with God or something like that. And anyway, long story short, I followed him into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, thinking that I was curious about what he was doing there. Why would a grown man drink milk with a sandwich, for God's sake? You know, it's just like, why do you go there? And so I said, if you're not alcoholic, can you go to these meetings? And he said, sure. So I did. I followed him in, and I haven't had a drink since that day. You know, there's the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. I went in there curious about what he was doing, and I did not know that I had a problem with alcohol until I went into that meeting, and I heard them say, if you have a desire to stop drinking, the third tradition, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. And I heard that echoed in my head. And when I went out to the parking lot, that's all I took out with me. And, you know, I didn't drink that night. And I went to a meeting the next day, and my arm shot up. And I was like, oh, Alice, I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't, it was like a whirlwind. I really didn't know what was happening to me. But I did, you know, I did. I sobered up, and it's been a long time. It's been a long time. And Tom and I met in Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sponsor said, don't do that, and I did anyway, and and we stuck together, and we've been through a lot, and we put each other through a lot, and we're just really thankful for sponsors and people that guide us in our lives. We've made a lot of mistakes, and we're still standing. And, you know, it's kind of surreal that we've actually lived through these years. I don't feel like, I have like 28 years of sobriety. I don't feel that old. I know I look that old, but I don't feel that old. It's gone by like this. If you tell me I have a 20-year-old son, it's just like, really? I have a little 8-year-old, you know, he's just about to come around the corner, but he's not. And that's not how it is. But home is good. And, the thing that Tom said about this meeting, I remember when he first went to this meeting and he came home, it's really, 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 really true that when he left the house, it was one of those times that actually wasn't a psychotic moment. He left the house, he came back another man, and he really was a different man because of what happened in this room that night. I remember thinking, you know, I felt like Lois when, you know, when Bill came home for that first time, and she was like, yeah, something really did happen to you. Something really did happen to him. There was a transformation where he became a different kind of a husband. It hasn't been like perfect since then, but it's been like so good. And we're so grateful to the men in this room, and I really am. I love coming here because I know all you men are here, and you've helped heal our home in such a huge way, such a huge way. So thanks for letting me come and share with you too.